Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. This week, Julia Reed is here with her new book, But Mama Always Put Vodka in Her Sangria. Julia's mixing it up with some controversial thoughts about the New Orleans food scene. Then, Tess Monahan introduces us to a new food system just debuting in Louisiana, the Good Egg Network. And Felder Rushing, the Gestalt Gardener's back to talk about the amazing power of a little radish. Get ready for some serious fun on this week's Louisiana Eats. No one knows how to eat, drink, and make merry quite like Julia Reed. Whether you followed her rollicking tales in the New York Times, Newsweek, or in her high and low regular column in Garden and Gun magazine, Julia always guarantees a thoroughly Southern good time. Julia Reed, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you very much, Poppy, for that sweet introduction.
Well, every word of it's true. And your new book, after all, is called But Mama Always Put Vodka in Her Sangria. Now, that's quite a title, and I guess you've got some splaining to do.
I do have some splaining. And when my editor came up with that as the title, I thought, oh, Lord. I was telling him the story, and he said, that's got to be the title. And the story goes like this. I was still writing the food column in the New York Times Magazine, and I had gone to Spain and fallen instantly in love with the cuisine. And so I smuggled all this stuff out of there, and I wanted to come back and try to recreate some recipes. And I was going to write a column on Spanish food. Every time I did a column like that, I would test the recipes on my friends first. And so I called up my good friend Elizabeth McGee Cortez and said, I'm having a Spanish dinner party. And she's like, great, I'll bring Mama's sangria. She's got this great sangria recipe. And her mother was my mother's best friend, and we all grew up together in Mississippi. And anyway, so I'm like, fine. I had no real interest in sangria. I'm not even sure I'd ever made any, you know, whatever. I just sort of vaguely knew what was in it, which is like red wine and sometimes a little cognac and Grand Marnier and some fruit. So anyway, she brings these fruity-looking nice pitchers of sangria, and we put them on the table, and I put out some hors d'oeuvres. And I go in the kitchen, and I had not been in that kitchen like maybe 20 minutes to finish cooking. And I come outside, and people are like making out with each other. I mean, it's like, you know, they're falling down in the bushes, doing totally inappropriate things, talking too loud, you know, laughing too hard. And I'm like, Elizabeth, she was still standing. I said, Elizabeth, what in the world did you put in that sangria? And she's like, a liter of vodka.
and so, the secret ingredient.
I know. And my mouth just fell open. And she's looking at me like I'm the one that was crazy. Like, of course she put a liter of vodka in the sangria. And so when I still didn't pick up my jaw off the floor, she said, well, Mama always put vodka in her sangria. So I said, that should be the title of your autobiography, because it said everything about growing up with her mother. But since she's not going to write an autobiography, I took it.
Well, it's really, really a good one. And
thank you.
Of course, you grew up in the Mississippi Delta.
I did.
And, you know, I have to say, reading about your life there, it really sounded like an inordinately fun place to grow up.
It was really fun. And part of the reason is because, I mean, you know, you're sitting around in the middle of the Mississippi Delta. There's not a whole lot to do all the time. The Delta was sort of a safe haven. It was not quite as violent as the rest of the state. And we had a great newspaper, Pulitzer Prize winning newspaper, you know, Hiding Carter the Second, who was originally from here, or from Hammond, wrote, you know, editorials that won in the Pulitzer Prize for preaching racial tolerance long before it was in vogue. And so we had a lot of people coming to town, and you have to give them a party. Yeah, that's when I decided I wanted to be a reporter, because every time a reporter came to town, they had a huge party for him. And, you know, he'd wake up off the floor in our living room, and I would be catching the school bus or something, and this guy would be sort of rearing his hungover head and writing, like, on the typewriter in those days, you know, Dateline Little Rock. And I'd be sort of smart aleck kid, like, aren't you supposed to be there?
Yeah.
He's like, shut up, kid. So I'm thinking, well, this is a great way to make a living.
Well, I have to say, you know, the whole thing, it's very elegant in that way that only Southern elegance somehow seems to do that. And the thing I think that was definitely the most intriguing and certainly shocked me was your chapter entitled Burger Heaven. Okay? If somebody had bet me $1 million who worked at McDonald's, you would have been dead last. Now, explain that.
I'm happy to hear that. I still have my polyester pantsuit with the zip front and the golden arches on it. I want you
and
to
you
know.
Loved it.
Well, it was fun. I mean, okay, so what happened was, yes, okay, so I wrecked my mother's car.
Uh-huh.
And I was 14.
What comes of all that partying.
Yeah. Well, it was the daytime. I was actually sober, and, you know, I'm 14, but I was not as good a driver as I thought, apparently. Anyway, so they're out of town. The first thing I try to do is fix the car. No avail. Plus, I didn't have any money. So I'm thinking, what can I do to, like, get maximum sympathy from my parents and make them almost forget that I've wrecked my mother's car that I shouldn't have been driving in the first place? So a classmate had told me that they were hiring underage kids at McDonald's. So there was a very nice, quote-unquote, manager there. I go down and get a job. It was totally unimpressive to my parents, who grounded me anyway. And now I'm, like, grounded, and I'm stuck working at McDonald's. But I started having a good time. I mean, it was sort of fun. We had a very hilarious night manager named Melvin, who ultimately absconded with the contents of the safe. But before he did that, he was a pretty heavy drinker. And he instructed us one night not to serve anybody Coke out of, like, that far-left Coke dispenser. And it turns out he hadn't found a novel way to make himself a bourbon and Coke. So he'd just be cruising through behind the counter. God only knows how many kids or teetotalers or whatever we got drunk accidentally. And so that was it. That was the beginning of my career. And I still love a Big Mac, I'll have you know.
Well, as Southern as all your stories are, you just take everybody along with you on this whirlwind world tour that is the life of Julia Reed. We go to Paris. We go to London. We even cruise the Nile.
So, we go to Afghanistan. That's right.
When was your first significant trip abroad, and what's your favorite place?
Oh, man, it's too hard to pick a favorite place, but when I first started working in magazines, they were still, like, big, huge money-making enterprises, unlike now. But, you know, and the budgets that we had in the early days at Newsweek and at Vogue were just enormous. I mean, I could no more get away with spending the kind of money we used to do. Now, it doesn't exist, but you used to be able to sort of live very well on an expense account. You know, so I had a lot of experiences in places that I never otherwise would have gone, which was great. I mean, my first trip abroad was to France because I was dying to go, and I was like, I was still 14 when that happened, you know, on a study abroad thing. But when I started working for Newsweek and then for Vogue, you know, I'd go to places that, like I said, I would never have gone on my own. Like, you don't wake up and say, I think I'm going to take a vacation and go on the Trans-Siberian Railway across Russia.
But that's a pretty nifty assignment.
It was, but, well, no. I mean, there was no, like, shower on the train. It was pretty horrible. And I was going to some women's conference in China, and there were a bunch of German lesbians and French intellectuals, and it was just, you know, it's like, okay, here I am on the train.
On the train with them.
But it was kind of fun, you know, and they, you know, and then I didn't have the right visa, and they dumped me in a forest in Novosibirsk and had to make my way back to Moscow. And in retrospect, those are always the great trips.
Of course. Well, I know that no matter where you travel, you always have that trusty mini bottle of Tabasco in your purse. And why is that?
Well, you can get through a lot of bad food with the help of Tabasco. I mean, there's a chapter in the book that you're referencing called Kill That Taste. And so you can start.
Unusual of food books.
I know.
Well,
I had a friend who was my colleague at Newsweek who had her whole entire refrigerator is full of stuff like chutneys and lime pickles and really strong tasting condiments and a ton of hot sauce. She was a good Georgia girl. And we both covered politics in those days. And, you know, you'd survive all these rubber chicken circuit dinners by just dousing stuff with Tabasco.
Well, I loved the way you approached this book by dividing it into three sections. And those sections are eating, drinking and making merry. And of course, the book is filled with all of this very cosmopolitan elegance. And there's chapters entitled Of Paris and Pins, Men and Martinis, and of course, Champagne Charlotte. Mm. But then, Julia, you bring up this concoction called Yucca Flat. So, you know, let's leave Paris and let's leave the Pims and just take us to the Yucca Flats.
Well, as much as I do love a Pimm's Cup and a Pimm's Royale, especially in the Ritz Bar in Paris, I have an equally big fondness for a Yucca Flats just because I don't know what made me think about it. I was writing a column for Newsweek, and I started thinking of summer drinks and how it changes and everybody starts putting more fruity things and you switch from dark to light liquor. And it reminded me of the Yucca Flats that I drank at our neighbor's house where I learned all kind of important things in life, like how to play poker and how to hold my beer. And, you know, it was my first experience with all the boys in the neighborhood. Our neighbor had this huge big playroom, and it had everything that you needed in life, like a pool table, a stereo, a poker table, and, an old couch. And in the summertime, the older boys would mix up a Yucca Flats in a trash can. So I started thinking, I wonder what was in there. I just remembered it being really delicious and like lots of squeezed lemons and limes floating around in there and some cherries and God only knows what else and a lot of ice. So I go online and I realize that like everybody's pretty much lived the same life because there are all these things online going, oh yeah, this is great to drink when you're having poker, or sometimes we mix it with our feet, and it's always in a garbage can. So I'm thinking this is like some international trend. The Yucca Flats, everybody had one at one point or another. Anyway, it's a delicious summer drink. So I sort of reimagined the recipe.
And it's quite a punch bowl. I mean, really.
It is. Well, a galvanized trash can can be very, very chic, I'll have you know.
Now,
I have like this whole dream of having a big party, having nothing but huge garbage cans full of Yucca Flats to be sort
really
of reverse chic. I'm telling you.
I love that idea.
Maybe I'll serve Big Macs alongside.
That'd be grand. Yeah, but just make sure that they're on a silver tray and there's a waiter.
Exactly.
Be right back with more outrageous talk from the outspoken Julia Reed. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Our conversation with writer Julia Reed continues as we explore why the Mississippi Delta-born former New Yorker chooses to call New Orleans her home. Well, you are a woman who can and has lived all sorts of places in the world, but you decided to make New Orleans your home. Why is that?
I got seduced, like everybody does. When I was a kid in the Delta, we'd either go north to Memphis or south to New Orleans, depending on how much time we wanted to spend in the car. And New Orleans usually won. You know, it's like people sort of think, well, if we leave now, we can get to Galatoire's, you know, in time for dinner or whatever. I found out that the train from Greenville, Mississippi, my hometown, did not stop until you got to New Orleans. There was no point in going anywhere else in Mississippi. And it was a direct train.
That's
it was
fabulous.
Like the shuttle. So there's always been an affinity. And then I came for Jazz Fest, and I had just gotten a contract to do a book of essays on the South, and I thought, well, maybe I should start spending time there again. I was living in New York, and I was down here for Jazz Fest, and Edwin Edwards was getting ready to run again, and it was against David Duke. And since I was not a tax-paying citizen of the state of Louisiana, that was like a great story and hilarious instead of sort of a tragic turn of events. And I'm like,
yeah, vote for the crook. It's important.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so I thought, I'll never see an election like this again, ever. And I thought, well, what the hell? I'll just come down. And I heard myself saying at about 3 o'clock in the morning after a post-Jazz Fest party, oh, yeah, I'm getting an apartment here. And I thought, well, then I guess I should.
Yeah.
And I did.
Well, I'm glad you did. And in your opinion, what do you think is the worst mistake that nervous hostesses often make?
Trying too hard, I think. You know, thinking, ooh, I'm having company over and I got to make some really incredibly overwrought, fancy thing. And I went through that when I was a kid and I was like the youngest person at Newsweek in the Washington Bureau. I didn't know how to cook because I, you know, grown up, as you said, watching my mother and her friends entertain and cooking. So I thought, well, I can impress them with, even though like they've actually have bylines and written books and stuff. I'm like, I can give a good dinner party. But instead of just sort of cooking a squash casserole or whatever, the first big dinner party I had, I was just drove my mother insane. And I'm calling her up on the phone. And it was during the advent of Nouvelle Cuisine. So in the New York Times in those days, there were all these fussy, complicated, but not actually very good sounding recipes. So I was driving Mama crazy on the phone in the days when long distance actually costs money.
Isn't that funny?
Do you think I should have this or this? And I'm going through all these recipes, and she finally just cut me off and said, why don't you just make something that tastes good? And it sounds silly, but it's not. I mean, I became a food writer entirely accidentally when I was still writing for Vogue, because I had a party for an editor there who was leaving, and it wasn't my usual crowd, but I had my usual menu, which was like biscuits with country ham on it and a big old bowl of crab meat maison like they make at Galatoire's.
That never fails, does
it? I know.
It?
Deviled eggs, which apparently nobody had ever seen before because they were like tracing the trays around. And these were in the days when in New York, you know, the most popular sort of cocktail party fare was stuff like dried out chicken satay on a stick, which is like so horrible. The next morning, this editor at the Times called me up and said, would you like to write about food? Because they'd never seen anything quite like a stuffed egg, apparently, or a ham biscuit.
Well, that was the best party ever then. Good. Congratulations. That was quite an accomplishment.
But, I mean, it just goes to show you, you know, it's like it really is, you know, have some food that tastes good. I mean, I always, my go-to hors d'oeuvre is things like fried oysters. I mean, what's not to love?
Well, in all of this entertaining talk, and I know you give dinner parties and, oh, there's Thanksgiving talk in your book, and I have never submitted anybody to, nor have I been submitted to, what you refer to as table talk.
Oh, God.
Would you explain that table talk thing?
Well, that chapter is going to ensure that I'm never invited back to a New York dinner party again, which is okay. No, I remember the first time that happened to me. I was at a dinner table at this sort of very famous book agent's house. And her husband was a writer, and there were all these sort of hoity-toity folks there. I was sitting next to a federal judge and Kimba Wood, who had just been turned down as or had to withdraw from being Clinton's attorney general nominee because she had the typical sort of she'd forgotten to pay her babysitter's taxes, that kind of stuff. But there are all these, you know, sort of tabloid names there. And at one point, you know, we were eating some not very delicious food, and the hostess goes, you know, ding, ding, ding on the glass. And says, okay, table talk. And she actually used the term. And we had to go around the table saying what we each thought about, like, you know, I can't remember now, like the latest Supreme Court nominee or, you know, what's going on with the current immigration bill or blah, blah. And instead of having like a discussion about that, which would be okay, it was literally like going around, you know, it's like when you're a kid and you have to say what you're thankful for at the table or whatever.
Yeah.
And it gave all these pompous people, you know, sort of a soapbox to stand on and talk endlessly. And it was just sort of, you've got to be kidding me. And then, like, I mean, I was with a couple of good friends and we hit the nearest bar and had to, like, drink ourselves into oblivion just to get over it. But, and then another time I was at a party, same thing happened. And this guy had just come back from the Gaza Strip and he starts talking about this. And my views on the subject were extremely different from his in the first place. But there was no chance of like having an argument with him because he never shut up.
Right.
You know, I'd rather be in a place where right after the Gaza Strip evening, I had a party at my mother's beach house in Florida. And everybody got in this like this big political discussion. We started beating one friend of mine on the head with a loaf of bread and stuff. I mean, it was a lot more fun just to have a full out good natured argument. And, you know,
yeah.
I mean, I just can't imagine anything worse than staged conversation.
No, contrived parties, not my cup of tea.
Scripted. Either. If you have to script your dinner party, you need some new friends.
I'll say. Okay, I've got a Julia Reed quote that I want to talk about. You once wrote, this is the quote, I want to own Antoine's restaurant in New Orleans so I can restore to the gorgeous and delicious temple of Creole cuisine that it once was. And I stay up late at night writing the daily specials
I would have on display
in the front room. Yeah, that was really quite something. Your aspirations are boundless. So
I would be good at running a restaurant.
What are you talking about?
Well, you know, Antoine's is just depressing these days. And I'm sure, I mean, we're both going to get mail saying, how dare you insult this bastion of New Orleans society, if not cuisine anymore. I mean, the first thing I do if I own Antoine's, just make that kind of food, but do it really well. And in the front room, you'd have a great oyster bar in there and have more like relaxed fare. Like on Mondays, you could have red beans and rice or whatever. I mean, just depressing because those rooms are so beautiful and you can make it so extraordinary. And I think it could be this really fun kind of temple of cuisine again.
Well, I am so grateful that you had a chance to stop over during one of your stops at home on this big tour.
I'm grateful that you asked me to be on the show. I'm a huge fan.
Oh,
this was fun, believe me.
Well, come back anytime.
I will.
Julia Reed in her new book, But Mama Always Put Vodka in Her Sangria. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero is always on the move, but considers New Orleans to be her heart's home. Because food is her passion, she has spent her life following what she calls the Okra Trail. By tracking the movement of okra as it traveled with the slave trade to the rest of the world, our hero became a leading authority on African food. From Benin to Brazil, our hero sought out the secrets of home cooks, learning and sharing those secrets with us all in her brilliant collection of books.
I found an article by Miss Manners, and she says, in Star Spangled Manners, a book that she wrote, she talks about the Southerners, and particularly the white Southerners, and says, and I'm quoting from her here, "Southerners were learning to practice African manners. It is not from the British that what came to be known as Southern graciousness was developed, with its open, easygoing style, its familial use of honorifics, and its y'all come to see us hospitality. The higher the Southern family's pretensions, the more likely the children were to be receiving daily etiquette instruction from someone whose strict sense of the fitting came from her own cultural background, the house slave."
Her books have taken us beyond gumbo and High on the Hog, two of her most popular titles. High on the Hog's invaluable content was recognized for its groundbreaking study of African-American food history and the cooks who created it, with an award by the International Association of Cooking Professionals.
It goes back to plantation humor, and actually there were a series of trickster tales that grew out of plantation humor and that had to do with the master and John, who would have been the enslaved person, so that at hog-killing time, Massa would come down to the cabins and say, "Come on, John, it's hog killing time. You're going to come and help me kill the hog, and I'm going to give you the head and the tail and the feet and the innards." And John said, "Yes, Massa." And that went on for years. And then one day John got his own hog. Then he got another hog. And that winter, when Massa came down to the quarters at hog killing time and said, "John, come on down, I've going to kill the hog," and John sort of said, "I don't rightly think so, Massa. I've got my own hog now, and I'm eating backbone and middling. I'm eating pork chops and bacon. I'm eating ham. I'm eating High on the Hog. Not the feet, but the ham."
That's why Dr. Jessica B. Harris is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Thank you, Jessica, for unraveling so many culinary mysteries of the African continent and explaining their place on our Louisiana table. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. You may be familiar with Felder Rushing from his long-running radio show, The Gestalt Gardener. Felder's joining us with the tale of a radish that helped grow a Mississippi boomtown at the turn of the last century. Felder, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Hey, glad to be here. Good to talk with you finally on your program. How you been?
Oh, I am great. And it was wonderful to see you at the Southern Foodways Alliance Symposium. And I have to admit, that was the first I had ever heard of the Long Beach radish.
The Long Beach red radish. A lot of people don't realize, back in the 1880s or so, Mississippi and Louisiana, parts of Alabama, were invaded by people from up in New England because they had cut down all their trees. The place looked like the moon up in Vermont. And so those folks, they cut down all of our forests. And, you know, when they cut all our forests, they left for somewhere else. And all of a sudden, we had a lot of open land, and people started growing truck crops for the first time. This is the first time we really had rail service, where they had ice and wooden barrels and stuff. And people from New Orleans and other places moved to Long Beach, Mississippi, which had some open area, really good fertile soil. And they started growing truck gardens back in the 1880s, and pretty quickly turned into mostly radish farming. As a matter of fact, Long Beach, Mississippi, which has radishes on its city flag, was founded entirely because of radishes.
And what year are we talking about?
1905. That's when it was incorporated. They were going that way before, but in a little over 100 years ago, somebody built an ice plant. Barrel manufacturers came in so they could take these radishes, put them in barrels, ice them down. And they were shipping railway cart loads of this particular unique radish up north, because back then one of the popular munchies is what we call it at the taverns up north with their beers, the working class folks would munch on stuff, and they really liked this very mild long red radish that was grown by, in some cases, Italian heritage farmers who moved from New Orleans over to South Mississippi. People were moving from Europe. They're coming from all over the country. There was a land rush along the Mississippi Gulf Coast because of the recently cleared forests, beautiful sandy loam soil, and the rail lines, you know, made it convenient to ship these things up north. One year, 1921, they sent 300 boxcar loads of iced down radishes up north.
Well, what did this do for the economy along the Gulf Coast?
Well, of course, you know, everything down the coast, you know, it comes and goes with agriculture and tourism and things like that. But 100 years ago, the place was fairly poor, and they had this newly opened up farmland. Towns started springing up. I think in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, just north of the Gulf Coast, 100 years ago, they had something like 28,000 farmers, and they were making as much as 25% more in income than urban workers were making. So they were well paid. There was a lot of interest. They were sending stuff up north. They were bringing goods back down. And, you know, there was a boom. They opened up a bank just to help support that local farming community. And there were so many Italian Americans at the time that little Long Beach, Mississippi, a tiny little town, almost halfway between Mobile and New Orleans, they even had a little place called Little Italy because of all the farmers.
Well, what happened to the radish? Why did it become almost extinct?
Well, for one thing, it was real popular. And by the way, let me explain about this, what they call the long red radish. You can still get seeds. Most of the heirloom places like Seed Savers and Southern Exchange, a lot of heirloom places, you can get this long red radish. But this long red Italian radish is fiery red. It looks like a bright red carrot. It's long, it's smooth, but it's got a real fine texture when you bite into it. It's not grainy or crunchy, and it's got a real mild flavor. And another reason why it grew so well, not only good long tap roots, but also grows really well in warm climates. We could grow it from August to September when we start planting it. Couldn't grow it so much right in the middle of the winter, but they could start planting again in the late winter. So it's a late summer, fall, and a late winter spring crop. And they were growing tons of it. Unfortunately, because everybody could grow it, there's nothing real special about it. It doesn't have to grow just in Long Beach, Mississippi. But because it was so popular up north, other people started growing it too. South Texas, Louisiana, Florida. So there started to be more competition. And there was actually a real strong emphasis to market it as a brand, sort of like Vidalia onion. You know, you can grow that onion anywhere in the South, but legally it can't be called Vidalia unless it comes from certain counties in Georgia, which happen to have lower sulfur content in their soil, so the Vidalia onions don't taste so hot. Anyway, the long red radish was marketed as the Long Beach long red radish, and people from all over the country were saying, you know, don't you know about Long Beach, Mississippi? It's the place to get radishes. Unfortunately, in the 1930s, when the Great Depression came along, a lot of banks went out of business, a lot of the shipping companies went out of business, and that put a lot of farmers in a bind, and so a lot of them went out of business, lost their farms, and then people started planting strawberries and things like that. And then on top of that, the taste for radishes went out of favor and people started noshing on other stuff.
Well, actually, though, you're encouraging people to start growing that radish again, right?
It's easy, Poppy. You can have these radishes in 5 or 6 weeks. You can plant seeds in the late summer, fall, or the late winter, spring and have carrot-sized radishes that are mild. They're not that hot thing like that little round cherry one that we've got. And you pull those babies and lay them on a plate as an appetizer or something like that. It looks good, makes you look like you're a good gardener. And a lot of these heirloom plants, vegetables, herbs, fruits, and the recipes need to be celebrated, not because they're old, but because they're good. They still work.
Felder, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to come and visit with us on Louisiana Eats, and I hope we can do this again soon.
My pleasure, Miss Poppy.
Felder Rushing, the Gestalt Gardener. We're coming back from the next short break with Tess Monahan of the Good Egg Network, a whole new way to get good food from good folks. Stay with us. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Tess Monahan is working on a new web platform called the Good Eggs Network that helps producers and consumers source their food locally. This unique system is already at work in the Bay Area, but is just launching here in Louisiana. Today, she's joined by one of Louisiana's first participants in the project, Nate Winner, also known as the NOLA Pie Guy. Tess and Nate, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Hi, Poppy.
Thanks for having us, Poppy.
Good Eggs has been described as the Eatsy of local food, and I'm not even sure that some of our listeners would catch that connection. So what's this all about?
So Good Eggs is a web platform that brings together local food producers and local food consumers. So the company was started in San Francisco 2 years ago by a group of Silicon Valley people and a group of people who'd worked in the local food system out there. And they came together and they said, okay, we want to build some sort of technology that will support local food systems. So the Good Eggs team talked to all these producers, and what they kept hearing was these producers wanted new ways to sell food directly to their customers. A lot of these vendors participated at farmers markets, which they loved. They loved being able to talk to their customers and to, you know, tell their customers about the food and to get those retail profit margins, to be honest. But farmers markets, you know, there are only so many a week and only so many people can get to them to buy there. And also, to participate in a farmer's market, the producer has to sit there for a certain number of hours and bring all their stuff there. So it's a great opportunity, but Good Eggs decided that they wanted to help producers find more opportunities to sell to those same types of customers who they could sell to at a farmer's market.
Let's be specific a little bit with New Orleans, because I think it's fascinating. Am I correct? Is New Orleans your second or third city to roll out?
Third city. Okay. We started in Brooklyn at the beginning of this year, and then we got started in New Orleans on a small scale at the beginning of April and have kind of slowly built things up. By the end of the summer, we anticipate having a couple of dozen vendors up and running on our site. We're working towards doing full-scale delivery in the fall.
Where, and how big would that range be of delivery?
So in the fall, what we're working towards is having a couple of dozen different businesses that you can order from and have that food delivered anywhere in the city of New Orleans. That's the goal come maybe September, October. That's what we're hoping for.
So right now, where's pickup?
So right now, the way it works is that we have a number of different options for pickup and delivery, and most of them are being completed by the vendors themselves. So for example, Nate, he'll deliver in the city of New Orleans. He'll deliver a pie for $5, Nate, is it?
That's correct. $4.99 extra charge. I'll deliver to any home or office located in New Orleans.
So people can choose, okay, if I just want to pay for the pie and I want to pick it up at Nate's currently based out of the PJs on Magazine, and then they just pay for the cost of the pie. Or they can say, well, I want the convenience of home delivery. I'll pay that extra $4.99 and then Nate will deliver it. We don't have our own warehouse and trucks just yet.
Yeah.
Every vendor is doing fulfillment that makes sense for them. So Hollygrove Market and Farm, for example, they already were doing home delivery when we approached them.
Their selection was really fantastic between herbs and starter plants, and it was very enticing on the site.
Yeah, they already have such an amazing network of farmers and other producers that they work with. We're really excited to have them on board. And they were working with another software company to do their home delivery, and it was just not a very friendly software program, either for the customer or for Hollygrove. It wasn't giving them a lot of flexibility of how they could set different products up on the site. It was pretty limited, and people had to opt into a 4 or 8 or 12 week subscription. And they had to pay for that up front.
A little bit more like your standard CSA type setup.
Exactly.
Community supported agriculture, where you get a box and it's kind of a mystery box, but from Good Eggs, it's never a mystery.
Right. That's a huge part of the kind of consumer end issue that we're trying to address, is people want to support local food and they want to buy local. But there's always a tension between, one, do I have the money to pay up front for a CSA share? Because typical CSA shares, you're paying, you know, several hundred dollars, maybe more, at the beginning of a 8 or 12 week season. And some people don't have that cash flow. And then the other piece is then, well, what if you go out of town during that time period? Or what if you just really don't like certain vegetables? So we're trying to give people a much wider selection to pick and choose the local food that they want to buy. Another piece is the education piece. So there are people who shop at Hollygrove regularly who would be interested in learning about other local food businesses who might not know about them. So another aspect of the Good Egg site is it provides a forum for people to see a full range of different types of local food businesses. And they go there to shop from Hollygrove, but then they see, oh, wow, this guy's making local pies with local ingredients, and these guys are doing this amazing grass-fed lamb. And people start to cross-shop. And it really, we see this platform as a place that supports all of the businesses involved, because they get to engage in this community.
And is this site intended for every man? So it doesn't matter if you are a mother feeding a small family or a chef. Do you get both types of customers on the site?
That's a really good question. So we are definitely first and foremost a consumer-facing site. There are ways that chefs and other institutional and wholesale type customers can use our site. And we do have some producers in New Orleans that are using it to sell small quantities of produce to restaurants, because there's so many urban growers now in New Orleans that are forging these great direct relationships with restaurants. In San Francisco, where the site was started, the Good Eggs team found that most of the restaurants there that wanted to source locally already had really solid relationships with farmers. Because in the Bay Area and the surrounding areas, there are a lot of farms that are a little more developed as far as the diversity of product and the kind of how they sell product to customers.
Well, when you're growing in the Garden of Eden, it's all very easy. It's a little
right.
different when you go to the swamp.
The swamp is a different kind of challenge. So in San Francisco, they didn't see as much of a need to serve restaurant and institutional customers with this software. But as we move into other cities where those connections between restaurants and farmers are not as well developed, we're starting to see the need for that type of platform. So the company will probably be launching a more wholesale-focused version of the software in the fall. So that's just one of the challenges that we're going to be adapting to as we roll out a wholesale platform.
Well, Nate, I have been watching your pie business since you first appeared on the scene baking pies as the pie guy. But for people who perhaps have never met you, how did this pie thing start?
Absolutely. So as you remember, I started in about late 2011. I've always been a fan of baking and pastry. I'm from Shreveport, Louisiana originally, and there's an old institution in Shreveport called Strawn's. Strawn's is just the local diner. It's where everybody goes for a good plate lunch, and at the end of a meal, you get a slice of homemade icebox pie. Seasonal fruits or chocolate or butterscotch, whatever your flavor, they've got it. It's piled high with homemade whipped cream, and it was delicious, and I missed that. I'd been living in New Orleans. I've been here about 5 years now, and at the time when I started Nola Pie Guy, there wasn't a place that was known for having just really solid pie that was their signature item. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to bring that little bit of nostalgia with me to New Orleans, because pie is something that I think, especially in America, not necessarily just the South or Louisiana, but America in general, growing up here, everybody has some connection to pie. It's a very nostalgic dessert. It takes everybody to a certain place, be it their childhood or otherwise, and they all have their favorite one. So I wanted to start to create that with my own business and my love of sweets and kind of share that in the city.
And so how did you and the Good Eggs find each other?
So I was introduced through Tess about a year and a half ago, and we were reintroduced by a mutual friend more recently. And she said, you know, Nate, I've kind of been following you with Nola Pie Guy. I'm getting involved with something I think you could really benefit from. Can we set up a time to talk next week? I said, absolutely. So we met in my neighborhood right down the street from the PJs, where I'm doing all my baking now, and had a good talk with Tess and another friend from the original Bay Area Good Eggs team, and it sounded like a wonderful idea on a whole lot of levels, and I was eager to get on board.
So what are you hoping that this relationship's going to do for you?
Sure. So for me personally, it makes sense on a couple different levels, one for New Orleans and one just for small business. So as a small business person, overhead is always an issue, right? So the onboarding process from a producer's perspective, they couldn't have made it easier. They hired a local photographer to take good pictures of my food for the web stand. I've got a variety of buyer options. So instead of just selling a single pie to a customer online, there's an automatic option for them to subscribe. So it just makes it that much easier to generate repeat business, which is, you know, it's a gold mine. That's what I want as a producer. I want those repeat customers. It puts me into a network that's very forward-thinking and progressive in this city and kind of attracts that like-minded crowd and set up events. So we've done everything from Good Eggs events. I've got a very user-friendly web platform, and that's user-friendly for my customers and for me as a business owner. If I know that I've only got one pallet of strawberries to work with, and from that pallet I'm only going to be able to make a dozen or so pies, then I can set my maximum to my strawberry pies that week to 12. Mm-hmm. And as soon as those 12 are set up, it's going to show sold out on the website. So it just makes it very easy for me to own and operate a small business, so I don't have to worry about so much on the technical end and can focus on the part I love most, which is making the pies.
Does anyone worry at all that there's perhaps some jeopardy of something being lost in a digital transaction versus a face-to-face interaction?
Absolutely. And that was addressed in the initial meeting I had with Good Eggs. And that's, I didn't even have to bring it up. They made it a point up front to tell me, like, we don't want this to be something where, like, you're shipping pies nationwide. Like, the purpose of Good Eggs is to put the producer and the farmer's face in front of the customer and the end user. There's kind of an emotional connection there that can get lost in some online businesses. they're very diligent about making sure that that's not the case with Good Eggs in each of their producers. So they want people that, like, for instance, where I can deliver the pie to your front door. I don't do pickup only. I love that customer interaction. And it's great for businesses that are starting up because you're able to put a face to the name, right?
Oh, I'm sure that the people, you get a big smile when you show up with a pie at somebody's front door. I'm sure of that. Yeah. So where else do the Good Egg plan on rolling into? What's going to happen
everywhere? So we're launching in Los Angeles. We don't have immediate plans for our next couple of cities. I think the goal is to see how things go with Brooklyn, New Orleans, and Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And then probably by, yeah. And then, but we want to be, we want 100 Good Eggs. You know,
that's
we want
Good
Eggs in 100
Good
places.
Eggs.
Yeah. It's a lot of eggs. It's a lot of eggs. So probably in the fall, we'll be, you know, starting to think about our next handful of cities.
Well, it's really exciting. It's really visionary. And I'm hoping that after people hear about this, on Louisiana Eats, it'll inspire both producers and shoppers to jump on the Good Egg Network because it all sounds good to me. So come back and see us.
We will, Poppy. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Poppy. Bye-bye.
Tess Monahan and the NOLA Pie Guy, Nate Winner, part of the visionary new food system, the Good Eggs Network.
Homegrown's all right with me. Homegrown is the way it should be. Homegrown is a good thing. Plant that bell and let it ring. Homegrown. Homegrown.
Frank McManus is our Baton Rouge-based Louisiana Eats roving reporter, and he is a food fanatic who is always on the hunt for fascinating new food stories just for us. So, Frank, what have you got for us today?
Oh, Poppy, there's all kinds of stuff to talk about, but I'd really like to talk about this great local pasta-making company called Frazina's. They use machines and dyes to cut their pasta that have been in their family for three generations. The original equipment was made in 1926, and they crank out fresh pasta that's used not only by a lot of local restaurants, but it's also available for retail in their shop. And they do your standard kind of pastas, you know, like linguine, which actually happens to be my favorite cut, you know, as well as fettuccine, lasagna, penne, that sort of thing. And then they also do some seasonal items that are dyed with natural dyes like beets and spinach and that sort of thing to do green and purple and gold pasta for Mardi Gras. And they've gotten some new dye cutters and they make tiger head pastas. And I think we all know what that's for.
Yeah.
They do a whole wheat pasta, too. They also do a spelt pasta.
Really?
But the, they do. They've really got a tremendous variety. They also have their own line of olive oils and balsamic vinegars and pasta sauces and that kind of thing. And a lot of just Italian specialties in general. But where they really shine is just, to my mind, in their standard pasta. And you can make just a fabulous carbonara with their linguine or with fresh shrimp. I've had all kinds of great stuff. It really, you know, like a pesto, if you've got some basil growing in the yard this summer, it just really, really shines on their pasta.
Well,
I love it.
Tell me, do they sell their pastas fresh or are they dried?
Both. It depends on if you go maybe Wednesdays and Fridays, they make the pasta. You can get the still moist pasta, but most of it is dried and packed and sold.
Frank,
it's definitely worth a trip.
I guess all that's left to say in this interview is ciao.
Bye, Poppy. Thank you.
Louisiana Eats roving reporter Frank McMahon. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we've got the scoop on Tulane Med School's Refresh Project, a new concept that combines good eating and good medicine.
We had thought originally we would maybe have about a 2,000 or 3,000 square foot teaching kitchen. We'll have a 4,500 square foot teaching kitchen. We'll be able to teach 16 to 20 people hands-on cooking skills. So for us, yeah, this has turned into a really different project. And people nationally are recognizing that maybe this is a solution, or at least part of a solution, for the problems that we have with lifestyle-related diseases.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lightseagan and Westside Lightseagan Funeral Homes, LCI Workers Comp, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.